This is Audible.
HarperCollins and Harper Audio present Unite Me by Tahira Mafi, performed by Dan Bittner, James Foey, and Kate Simses. Destroy Me. Prologue. I've been shot. And, as it turns out, a bullet wound is even more uncomfortable than I had imagined. My skin is cold and clammy. I'm making a Herculean effort to breathe. Torture is roaring through my right arm and making it difficult for me to focus. I have to squeeze my eyes shut, grit my teeth, and force myself to pay attention. The chaos is unbearable. Several people are shouting and too many of them are touching me, and I want their hands surgically removed. They keep shouting, "Sir," as if they're still waiting for me to give them orders, as if they have no idea what to do without my instruction. The realization exhausts me. "Sir, can you hear me?" Another cry, but this time a voice I don't detest. "Sir, please, can you hear me? I've been shot, De La Lue," I manage to say. I open my eyes, look into his watery ones. "I haven't gone deaf." All at once, the noise disappears. The soldiers shut up. De La Lue looks at me, worried. I sigh. "Take me back," I tell him, shifting just a little. The world tilts and steadies all at once. "Alert the medics and have my bed prepared for our arrival. In the meantime, elevate my arm and continue applying direct pressure to the wound. The bullet has broken or fractured something, and this will require surgery." De La Lue says nothing for just a moment too long. "Good to see you're all right, sir." His voice is a nervous, shaky thing. "Good to see you're all right." "That was an order, Lieutenant." "Of course," he says quickly, head bowed. "Certainly, sir. How should I direct the soldiers?" "Find her," I tell him. It's getting harder for me to speak. I take a small breath and run a shaky hand across my forehead. I'm sweating in an excessive way that isn't lost on me.
"Yes, sir."
He moves to help me up, but I grab his arm.
"One last thing."
"Sir?"
"Kent," I say, my voice uneven now. "Make sure they keep him alive for me."
De La Lue looks up, his eyes wide.
"Private Adam Kent, sir?"
"Yes." I hold his gaze. "I want to deal with him myself."
1. De La Lue is standing at the foot of my bed, clipboard in hand.
His is my second visit this morning.
The first was from my medics, who confirmed that the surgery went well. They said that as long as I stay in bed this week, the new drugs they've given me should accelerate my healing process. They also said that I should be fit to resume daily activities fairly soon, but I'll be required to wear a sling for at least a month. I told them it was an interesting theory.
"My slacks, De La Lue."
I'm sitting up, trying to steady my head against the nausea of these new drugs. My right arm is essentially useless to me now. I look up. De La Lue is staring at me, unblinking, Adam's apple bobbing in his throat. I stifle a sigh.
"What is it?"
I use my left arm to steady myself against the mattress and force myself upright. It takes every ounce of energy I have left, and I'm clinging to the bed frame. I wave away De La Lu's effort to help. I close my eyes against the pain and dizziness. Tell me what's happened, I say to him. There's no point in prolonging bad news. His voice breaks twice when he says, Private Adam, Kent, has escaped, sir. My eyes flash a bright, dizzying white behind my eyelids. I take a deep breath and attempt to run my good hand through my hair. It's thick and dry and caked with what must be dirt mixed with my own blood. I'm tempted to punch my remaining fist through the wall. Instead, I take a moment to collect myself. I'm suddenly too aware of everything in the air around me, the scents and small noises and footsteps outside my door. I hate these rough cotton pants they've put me in. I hate that I'm not wearing socks. I want to shower. I want to change. I want to put a bullet through Adam Kent's spine. Leeds, I demand. I move toward my bathroom and wince against the cold air as it hits my skin. I'm still without a shirt, trying to remain calm. Tell me you have not brought me this information without Leeds. My mind is a warehouse of carefully organized human emotions. I can almost see my brain as it functions, filing thoughts and images away. I lock away the things that do not serve me. I focus only on what needs to be done, the basic components of survival, and the myriad things I must manage throughout the day. Of course, De La Lu says. The fear in his voice stings me a little. I dismiss it. Yes, sir, he says. We do think we know where he might have gone, and we have reason to believe that Private Kent and the girl, well, with Private Kishimoto having run off as well, we have reason to believe that they are all together, sir. The drawers in my mind are rattling to break open. Memories, theories, whispers and sensations. I shove them off a cliff. Of course you do. I shake my head, regret it, close my eyes against the sudden unsteadiness. Do not give me information I've already deduced for myself, I manage to say. I want something concrete. Give me a solid lead, Lieutenant, or leave me until you have one. A car, he says quickly. A car was reported stolen, sir, and we were able to track it to an unidentified location, but then it disappeared off the map. It's as if it ceased to exist, sir. I look up, give him my full attention. We followed the tracks it left in our radar, he says, speaking more calmly now, and they led us to a stretch of isolated, barren land, but we've scoured the area and found nothing. This is something, at least. I rub the back of my neck, fighting the weakness I feel deep in my bones. I will meet you in the L room in 1 hour. But, sir, he says, eyes trained on my arm, you'll need assistance. There's a process. You'll require a convalescent aid. You are dismissed. He hesitates. Then, yes, sir. 2. I managed to bathe without losing consciousness. It was more of a sponge bath, but I feel better nonetheless. I have an extremely low threshold for disorder. It offends my very being. I shower regularly. I eat 6 small meals a day. I dedicate 2 hours of each day to training and physical exercise, and I detest being barefoot. Now I find myself standing naked, hungry, tired, and barefoot in my closet. This is not ideal. My closet is separated into various sections. Shirts, ties, slacks, blazers, and boots. Socks, gloves, scarves, and coats. Everything is arranged according to color, then shades within each color. Every article of clothing it contains is meticulously chosen and custom-made to fit the exact measurements of my body. I don't feel like myself until I'm fully dressed. It's part of who I am and how I begin my day. Now, I haven't the faintest idea how I'm supposed to dress myself. My hand shakes as I reach for the little blue bottle I was given this morning. I place two of the square-shaped pills on my tongue and allow them to dissolve. I'm not sure what they do. I only know they help replenish the blood I've lost. So I lean against the wall until my head clears and I feel stronger on my feet. This, such an ordinary task. It wasn't an obstacle I was anticipating. I put socks on first. A simple pleasure that requires more effort than shooting a man. Briefly, I wonder what the medics must have done with my clothes. The clothes, I tell myself. Only the clothes. I'm focusing only on the clothes from that day. Nothing else. No other details. Boots, socks, slacks, sweater. My military jacket with its many buttons. The many buttons she ripped open. It's a small reminder, but it's enough to spear me. I try to fight it off, but it lingers. And the more I try to ignore the memory, it multiplies into a monster that can no longer be contained. I don't even realize I've fallen against the wall until I feel the cold climbing up my skin. I'm breathing too hard and squeezing my eyes shut against the sudden wash of mortification. I knew she was terrified. Horrified even. But I never thought those feelings were directed toward me. I'd seen her evolve as we spent time together. She seemed more comfortable as the weeks passed. Happier. At ease. I allowed myself to believe she'd seen a future for us. That she wanted to be with me and simply thought it impossible. I'd never suspected that her newfound happiness was a consequence of Kent. I run my good hand down the length of my face, cover my mouth. The things I said to her. A tight breath. The way I touched her. My jaw tenses. If it were nothing but sexual attraction, I'm sure I would not suffer such unbearable humiliation. But I wanted so much more than her body. All at once, I implore my mind to imagine nothing but walls. Walls. White walls. Blocks of concrete. Empty rooms. Open space. I build walls until they begin to crumble, and then I force another set to take their place. I build and build and remain unmoving until my mind is clear, uncontaminated, containing nothing but a small white room. A single light hanging from the ceiling. Clean, pristine, undisturbed. I blink back the flood of disaster pressing against the small world I've built. I swallow hard against the fear creeping up my throat. I push the walls back, making more space in the room until I can finally breathe, until I'm able to stand. Sometimes, I wish I could step outside of myself for a while. I want to leave this worn body behind, but my chains are too many, my weight's too heavy. This life is all that's left of me, and I know I won't be able to meet myself in the mirror for the rest of the day. I'm suddenly disgusted with myself. I have to get out of this room as soon as possible, or my own thoughts will wage war against me. I make a hasty decision and for the first time pay little attention to what I'm wearing. I tug on a fresh pair of pants and go without a shirt. I slip my good arm into the sleeve of a blazer and allow the other shoulder to drape over the sling carrying my injured arm. I look ridiculous, exposed like this, but I'll find a solution tomorrow. First, I have to get out of this room. 3. De La Lu is the only person here who does not hate me. he still spends the majority of his time in my presence cowering in fear. But somehow he has no interest in overthrowing my position. I can feel it, though I don't understand it. He's likely the only person in this building who's pleased that I'm not dead. I hold up a hand to keep away the soldiers who rush forward as I open my door. It takes an intense amount of concentration to keep my fingers from shaking as I wipe the slight sheen of perspiration off my forehead. But I will not allow myself a moment of weakness. These men do not fear for my safety. They only want a closer look at the spectacle I've become. They want a first look at the cracks in my sanity. But I have no wish to be wondered at. My job is to lead. I've been shot. It will not be fatal. There are things to be managed. I will manage them. This wound will be forgotten. Her name will not be spoken. My fingers clench and unclench as I make my way toward the L room. I never before realized just how long these corridors are, and just how many soldiers line the halls. There's no reprieve from their curious stares and their disappointment that I did not die. I don't even have to look at them to know what they're thinking, but knowing how they feel only makes me more determined to live a very long life. I will give no one the satisfaction of my death. No. I wave away the tea and coffee service for the fourth time. I do not drink caffeine, De La Lue. Why do you always insist on having it served at my meals? I suppose I always hope you will change your mind, sir. I look up. De La Lue is smiling that strange, shaky smile, and I'm not entirely certain, but I think he just made a joke. Why? I reach for a slice of bread. I am perfectly capable of keeping my eyes open. Only an idiot would rely on the energy of a bean or a leaf to stay awake throughout the day. De La Lue is no longer smiling. Yes, he says, certainly, sir, and stares down at his food. I watch as his fingers push away the coffee cup. I drop the bread back onto my plate. My opinions, I say to him, quietly this time, should not so easily break your own. Stand by your convictions. Form clear and logical arguments, even if I disagree. Of course, sir, he whispers. He says nothing for a few seconds, but then I see him reach for his coffee again. De La Lue. He, I think, is my only course for conversation. He was originally assigned to this sector by my father, and has since been ordered to remain here until he's no longer able. And though he's likely 45 years my senior, he insists on remaining directly below me. I've known De La Lue's face since I was a child. I used to see him around our house, sitting in on the many meetings that took place in the years before the re-establishment took over. There was an endless supply of meetings in my house. My father was always planning things, leading discussions and whispered conversations I was never allowed to be a part of. The men of those meetings are running this world now. So when I look at De La Lue, I can't help but wonder why he never aspired to more. He was a part of this regime from the very beginning, but somehow seems content to die just as he is now. He chooses to remain subservient, even when I give him opportunities to speak up. He refuses to be promoted, even when I offer him higher pay. And while I appreciate his loyalty, his dedication unnerves me. He does not seem to wish for more than what he has. I should not trust him. And yet, I do. But I've begun to lose my mind for a lack of companionable conversation. I cannot maintain anything but a cool distance from my soldiers, not only because they all wish to see me dead, but also because I have a responsibility as their leader to make unbiased decisions. I have sentenced myself to a life of solitude, one wherein I have no peers, and no mind but my own to live in. I look to build myself as a feared leader, and I've succeeded. No one will question my authority, or posit a contrary opinion. No one will speak to me as anything but the chief commander and regent of Sector 45. Friendship is not a thing I have ever experienced, not as a child, and not as I am now. Except. 1 month ago, I met the exception to this rule. There has been one person who's ever looked me directly in the eye. The same person who's spoken to me with no filter. Someone who's been unafraid to show anger and real, raw feeling in my presence. The only one who's ever dared to challenge me, to raise her voice to me. I squeeze my eyes shut for what feels like the 10th time today. I unclench my fist around this fork, drop it to the table. My arm has begun to throb again, and I reach for the pills tucked away in my pocket.
You shouldn't take more than 8 of those within a 24-hour period, sir.
I open the cap and toss 3 more into my mouth. I really wish my hands would stop shaking. My muscles feel too tight, too tense, stretched thin. I don't wait for the pills to dissolve. I bite down on them, crunching against their bitterness. There's something about the foul, metallic taste that helps me focus. Tell me about Kent. De La Lue knocks over his coffee cup. The dining aides have left the room at my request. De La Lue receives no assistance as he scrambles to clean up the mess. I sit back in my chair, staring at the wall just behind him, mentally tallying up the minutes I've lost today. Leave the coffee.
Yes, of course. Sorry, sir.
Stop. De La Lue drops the sopping napkins. His hands are frozen in place, hovering over his plate. Speak. I watch his throat move as he swallows, hesitates.
We don't know, sir,
he whispers.
The building should have been impossible to find, much less to enter. It had been bolted and rusted shut, but when we found it, he says, when we found it, it was... The door had been destroyed, and we're not sure how they managed it.
I sit up. What do you mean, destroyed? He shakes his head.
It was... very odd, sir. The door had been... mangled, as if some kind of animal had clawed through it. There was only a gaping, ragged hole in the middle of the frame.
I stand up entirely too fast, gripping the table for support. I'm breathless at the thought of it, at the possibility of what must have happened, and I can't help but allow myself the painful pleasure of recalling her name once more, because I know it must have been her. She must have done something extraordinary, and I wasn't even there to witness it. Call for transport, I tell him. I will meet you in the quadrant in exactly 10 minutes.
Sir?
I'm already out the door. 4. Clawed through the middle, just like an animal. It's true. To an unsuspecting observer, it would be the only explanation, but even then it wouldn't make any sense. No animal alive could claw through this many inches of reinforced steel without amputating its own limbs. And she is not an animal. She is a soft, deadly creature, kind and timid and terrifying. She's completely out of control and has no idea what she's capable of. And even though she hates me, I can't help but be fascinated by her. I'm enchanted by her pretend innocence. Jealous, even,
of the power she wields so unwittingly. I want so much to be a part of her world. I want to know what it's like to be in her mind, to feel what she feels. It seems a tremendous weight to carry. And now she's out there, somewhere, unleashed on society. What a beautiful disaster. I run my fingers along the jagged edges of the hole, careful not to cut myself. There's no design to it, no premeditation. Only an anguished fervor so readily apparent in the chaotic ripping apart of this door. I can't help but wonder if she knew what she was doing when this happened, or if it was just as unexpected to her as it was the day she broke through that concrete wall to get to me. I have to stifle a smile. I wonder how she must remember that day. Every soldier I've worked with has walked into a simulation knowing exactly what to expect, but I purposely kept those details from her. I thought the experience should be as undiluted as possible. I hoped the spare, realistic elements would lend authenticity to the event. More than anything else, I wanted her to have a chance to explore her true nature, to exercise her strength in a safe space, and given her past, I knew a child would be the perfect trigger. But I never could have anticipated such revolutionary results. Her performance was more than I had hoped for, and though I wanted to discuss the effects with her afterward, by the time I found her, she was already planning her escape. My smile falters.
"Would you like to step inside, sir?"
De La Lu's voice jolts me back to the present.
"There's not much to see within, but it is interesting to note that the hole is just big enough for someone to easily climb through. It seems clear, sir, what the intent was."
I nod, distracted. My eyes carefully catalog the dimensions of the hole. I try to imagine what it must have been like for her, to be here, trying to get through. I want so much to be able to talk to her about all of this. My heart twists so suddenly. I'm reminded, all over again, that she's no longer with me. She does not live on base anymore. It's my fault she's gone. I allowed myself to believe she was finally doing well, and it affected my judgment. I should have been paying closer attention to details, to my soldiers. I lost sight of my purpose and my greater goal, the entire reason I brought her on base. I was stupid, careless. But the truth is, I was distracted by her. She was so stubborn and childish when she first arrived. But as the weeks passed, she'd seemed to settle. She felt less anxious to me, somehow less afraid. I have to keep reminding myself that her improvements had nothing to do with me. They had to do with Kent. A betrayal that somehow seemed impossible. That she would leave me for a robotic, unfeeling idiot like Kent. His thoughts are so empty, so mindless, it's like conversing with a desk lamp. I don't understand what he could have offered her, what she could have possibly seen in him except a tool for escape. She still hasn't grasped that there's no future for her in the world of common people. She doesn't belong in the company of those who will never understand her. And I have to get her back. I only realize I've said that last bit out loud when De La Lu speaks. "We have troops all across the sector searching for her," he says, "and we've alerted the neighboring sectors, just in case the group of them should cross over." "What?" I spin around, my voice a quiet, dangerous thing.
"What did you just say?"
De La Lu has turned a sickly shade of white.
"I was unconscious for all of one night. And you've already alerted the other sectors to this catastrophe." "I thought you would want to find them, sir, and I thought if they should try to seek refuge elsewhere."
I take a moment to breathe, to gather my bearings. "I'm sorry, sir. I thought it would be safest." "She is with two of my own soldiers, Lieutenant. Neither one of them are stupid enough to guide her toward another sector. They have neither the clearance nor the tools to obtain said clearance in order to cross the sector line. But they've been gone one day. They are badly wounded and in need of aid. They're traveling on foot and with a stolen vehicle that is easily trackable. How far, I say to him, frustration breaking into my voice, could they have gone?
De La Luz says nothing.
You have sent out a national alert. You've notified multiple sectors, which means the entire country now knows. Which means the capitals have received word. Which means what?
I curl my only working hand into a fist.
What do you think that means, Lieutenant?
For a moment he seems unable to speak. Then,
sir, he gasps, please forgive me.
5. De La Lue follows me to my door. Gather the troops in the quadrant tomorrow at 10:00, I say to him by way of goodbye. I'll have to make an announcement about these recent events as well as what's to come.
Yes, sir,
De La Lue says. He doesn't look up. He hasn't looked at me since we left the warehouse. I have other matters to worry about. Not counting De La Lue's stupidity, there are an infinite number of things I must take care of right now. I can't afford any more difficulties, and I cannot be distracted. Not by her, not by De La Lue, not by anyone. I have to focus. This is a terrible time to be wounded. News of our situation has already hit a national level. Civilians in neighboring sectors are now aware of our minor uprising, and we have to tamp down the rumors as much as possible. I have to somehow defuse the alerts De La Lue has already sent out, and simultaneously suppress any hope of rebellion among the citizens. They're already too eager to resist, and any spark of controversy will reignite their fervor. Too many have died already, and they still don't seem to understand that standing against the reestablishment is asking for more destruction. The civilians must be pacified. I do not want war in my sector. Now more than ever, I need to be in control of myself and my responsibilities. But my mind is scattered, my body fatigued and wounded. All day I've been inches from collapsing, and I don't know what to do. I have no idea how to fix it. This weakness is far into my being. In just 2 days, one girl has managed to cripple me. I've taken even more of these disgusting pills, but I feel weaker than I did this morning. I thought I could ignore the pain and inconvenience of a wounded shoulder. But the complication refuses to diminish. I am now wholly dependent on whatever will carry me through these next weeks of frustration. Medicine, medics, hours in bed. All this for a kiss. It's almost unbearable. I'll be in my office for the rest of the day, I tell De La Lue. Have my meal sent to my room, and do not disturb me unless there are any new developments.
Yes, sir.
That'll be all, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
I don't even realize how ill I feel until I close the bedroom door behind me. I stagger to the bed and grip the frame to keep from falling over. I'm sweating again and decide to strip the extra coat I wore on our outside excursion. I yank off the blazer I'd carelessly tossed over my injured shoulder this morning and fall backward onto my bed. I'm suddenly freezing. My good hand shakes as I reach for the medic call button. I need to get the dressing on my shoulder changed. I need to eat something substantial. And more than anything else, I desperately need to take a real shower, which seems altogether impossible. Someone is standing over me. I blink several times but can only make out the general outline of their figure. A face keeps coming in and out of focus until I finally give up. My eyes fall closed. My head is pounding. Pain is searing through my bones and up my neck. Reds and yellows and blues blur together behind my eyelids. I catch only clips of the conversation around me.
seems to have developed a fever, and probably sedate him. How many did he take?
They're going to kill me, I realize. This is the perfect opportunity. I'm weak and unable to fight back, and someone has finally come to kill me. This is it. My moment. It has arrived. And somehow I can't seem to accept it. I take a swipe at the voices. An inhuman sound escapes my throat. Something hard hits my fist and crashes to the floor. Hands clamp down on my right arm and pin it in place. Something is being tightened around my ankles, my wrist. I'm thrashing against these new restraints and kicking desperately at the air. The blackness seems to be pressing against my eyes, my ears, my throat. I can't breathe, can't hear or see clearly, and the suffocation of the moment is so terrifying that I'm almost certain I've lost my mind. Something cold and sharp pinches my arm. I have only a moment to reflect on the pain before it engulfs me. 6.
Juliet, I whisper, what are you doing here?
I'm half-dressed, getting ready for my day, and it's too early for visitors. These hours just before the sun rises are my only moments of peace, and no one should be in here. It seems impossible she gained access to my private quarters. Someone should have stopped her. Instead, she's standing in my doorway, staring at me. I've seen her so many times, but this is different. It's causing me physical pain to look at her, but somehow I still find myself drawn to her, wanting to be near her.
I'm so sorry, she says,
and she's wringing her hands, looking away from me.
I'm so, so sorry.
I notice what she's wearing. It's a dark green dress with fitted sleeves, a simple cut made of stretch cotton that clings to the soft curves of her figure. It complements the flecks of green in her eyes in a way I couldn't have anticipated. It's one of the many dresses I chose for her. I thought she might enjoy having something nice after being caged as an animal for so long. And I can't quite explain it, but it gives me a strange sense of pride to see her wearing something I picked out myself.
I'm sorry,
she says for the third time. I'm again struck by how impossible it is that she's here, in my bedroom, staring at me without my shirt on. Her hair is so long it falls to the middle of her back. I have to clench my fists against this unbidden need to run my hands through it. She's so beautiful. I don't understand why she keeps apologizing. She shuts the door behind her. She's walking over to me. My heart is beating quickly now, and it doesn't feel natural. I do not react this way. I do not lose control. I see her every day and manage to maintain some semblance of dignity, but something is off. This isn't right. She's touching my arm. She's running her fingers along the curve of my shoulder, and the brush of her skin against mine is making me want to scream. The pain is excruciating, but I can't speak. I'm frozen in place. I want to tell her to stop, to leave, but parts of me are at war. I'm happy to have her close, even if it hurts, even if it doesn't make any sense. But I can't seem to reach for her. I can't hold her like I've always wanted to. She looks at me. She searches me with those odd blue-green eyes, and I feel guilty so suddenly without understanding why. But there's something about the way she looks at me that always makes me feel insignificant. As if she's the only one who's realized I'm entirely hollow inside. She's found the cracks in this cast I'm forced to wear every day, and it petrifies me. That this girl would know exactly how to shatter me. She rests her hand against my collarbone. and then she grips my shoulder, digs her fingers into my skin like she's trying to tear off my arm. The agony is so blinding that this time I actually scream. I fall to my knees before her, and she wrenches my arm, twisting it backward until I'm heaving from the effort to stay calm, fighting not to lose myself to the pain. "Juliet," I gasp, "please." She runs her free hand through my hair, tugs my head back so I'm forced to meet her eyes, and then she leans into my ear, her lips almost touching my cheek.
"Do you love me?"
she whispers.
"What?"
I breathe. "What are you doing?
Do you still love me?"
she asks again, her fingers now tracing the shape of my face, the line of my jaw.
"Yes," I tell her. "Yes, I still do."
She smiles. It's such a sweet, innocent smile that I'm actually shocked when her grip tightens around my arm. She twists my shoulder back until I'm sure it's being ripped from the socket. I'm seeing spots when she says,
"It's almost over now."
"What is?" I ask, frantic, trying to look around. "What's almost over?"
"Just a little longer and I'll leave."
"No, no, don't go. Where are you going?"
"You'll be all right," she says. "I promise."
"No," I'm gasping. "No." All at once, she yanks me forward and I'm awake so quickly I can't breathe. I blink several times only to realize I've woken up in the middle of the night. Absolute blackness greets me from the corners of my room. My chest is heaving, my arm is bound and pounding, and I realize my pain medication has worn off. There's a small remote wedged under my hand. I press the button to replenish the dosage. It takes a few moments for my breathing to stabilize. My thoughts slowly retreat from panic.
"Juliet."
I can't control a nightmare, but in my waking moments, her name is the only reminder I will permit myself. The accompanying humiliation will not allow me much more than that. 7.
"Well, isn't this embarrassing? My son, tied down like an animal."
I'm half convinced I'm having another nightmare. I blink my eyes open slowly. I stare up at the ceiling. I make no sudden movements, but I can feel the very real weight of restraints around my left wrist and both ankles. My injured arm is still bound and slung across my chest, and though the pain in my shoulder is present, it's dulled to a light hum. I feel stronger. Even my head feels clearer, sharper somehow. But then I taste the tang of something sour and metal in my mouth and wonder how long I've been in bed.
"Did you really think I wouldn't find out?"
he asks, amused. He moves closer to my bed, his footsteps reverberating right through me.
"You have Delalu whimpering apologies for disturbing me, begging my men to blame him for the inconvenience of this unexpected visit. No doubt you terrified the old man for doing his job, when the truth is, I would have found out even without his alerts. This," he says, "is not the kind of mess you can conceal. You're an idiot for thinking otherwise."
I feel a light tugging on my legs and realize he's undoing my restraints. The brush of his skin against mine is abrupt and unexpected, and it triggers something deep and dark within me, enough to make me physically ill. I taste vomit at the back of my throat. It takes all my self-control not to jerk away from him.
"Sit up, son. You should be well enough to function now. You were too stupid to rest when you were supposed to, and now you've overcorrected. 3 days you've been unconscious, and I arrived 27 hours ago. Now get up. This is ridiculous.
I'm still staring at the ceiling, hardly breathing. He changes tactics.
You know, he says carefully, I've actually heard an interesting story about you.
He sits down on the edge of my bed. The mattress creaks and groans under his weight.
Would you like to hear it?
My left hand has begun to tremble. I clench it fast against the bedsheets.
Private 45B-76423. Fletcher, Seamus.
He pauses.
Does that name sound familiar?
I squeeze my eyes shut.
Imagine my surprise, he says, when I heard that my son had finally done something right, that he'd finally taken initiative and dispensed with a traitorous soldier who'd been stealing from our storage compounds. I heard you shot him right in the forehead. A laugh. I congratulated myself, told myself you'd finally come into your own, that you'd finally learned how to lead properly. I was almost proud. That's why it came as an even greater shock to me to hear Fletcher's family was still alive.
He claps his hands together.
Shocking, of course, because you, of all people, should know the rules. Traitors come from a family of traitors, and one betrayal means death to them all.
He rests his hand on my chest. I'm building walls in my mind again. White walls, blocks of concrete, empty rooms and open space. Nothing exists inside of me. Nothing stays.
It's funny,
he continues, thoughtful now.
Because I told myself I'd wait to discuss this with you. But somehow, this moment seems so right, doesn't it?
I can hear him smile.
To tell you just how tremendously disappointed I am. Though I can't say I'm surprised.
He sighs.
In a single month, you've lost two soldiers, couldn't contain a clinically insane girl, upended an entire sector, and encouraged rebellion among the citizens. And somehow, I'm not surprised at all.
His hand shifts, lingers at my collarbone. White walls, I think. Blocks of concrete. Empty rooms, open space. Nothing exists inside of me. Nothing stays.
But what's worse than all this, he says, is not that you've managed to humiliate me by disrupting the order I'd finally managed to establish. It's not even that you somehow got yourself shot in the process, but that you would show sympathy to the family of a traitor.
He says, laughing, his voice a happy, cheerful thing.
This is unforgivable.
My eyes are open now, blinking up at the fluorescent lights above my head, focused on the white of the bulbs blurring my vision. I will not move. I will not speak. His hand closes around my throat. The movement is so rough and violent, I'm almost relieved. Some part of me always hopes he'll go through with it, that maybe this time he'll actually let me die. But he never does. It never lasts. Torture is not torture when there's any hope of relief. He lets go all too soon and gets exactly what he wants. I jerk upward, coughing and wheezing and finally making a sound that acknowledges his existence in this room. My whole body is shaking now, my muscles in shock from the assault and from remaining still for so long. My skin is cold sweat. My breaths are labored and painful.
You're very lucky,
he says, his words too soft. He's up now, no longer inches from my face.
So lucky I was here to make things right. So lucky I had time to correct the mistake.
I freeze. The room spins.
I was able to track down his wife, he says. Fletcher's wife and their three children. I hear they sent their regards.
A pause.
Well, this was before I had them killed, so I suppose it doesn't really matter now. But my men told me they said hello. It seems she remembered you,
he says, laughing softly.
The wife. She said you went to visit them before all this unpleasantness occurred. You were always visiting the compounds, she said, asking after the civilians.
I whisper the only two words I can manage.
Get out.
This is my boy,
he says, waving a hand in my direction.
A meek, pathetic fool. Some days I'm so disgusted by you, I don't know whether to shoot you myself. And then I realize you'd probably like that, wouldn't you? To be able to blame me for your downfall? And I think no. Best to let him die of his own stupidity.
I stare blankly ahead, fingers flexing against the mattress.
Now tell me, he says, what happened to your arm? Delalu seemed as clueless as the others.
I say nothing.
Too ashamed to admit you were shot by one of your own soldiers, then.
I close my eyes.
And what about the girl? He asks. How did she escape? Ran off with one of your men, didn't she?
I grip the bedsheet so hard my fist starts shaking.
Tell me,
he says, leaning into my ear.
How would you deal with a traitor like that? Are you going to go visit his family too? Make nice with his wife?
And I don't mean to say it out loud, but I can't stop myself in time.
I'm going to kill him.
He laughs out loud so suddenly it's almost a howl. He claps a hand on my head and musses my hair with the same fingers he just closed around my throat.
Much better, he says. So much better. Now get up. We have work to do.
And I think yes. I wouldn't mind doing the kind of work that would remove Adam Kent from this world. A traitor like him does not deserve to live. 8. I'm in the shower for so long, I actually lose track of time. This has never happened before. Everything is off, unbalanced. I'm second-guessing my decisions, doubting everything I thought I didn't believe in. And for the first time in my life, I am genuinely, bone-achingly tired. My father is here. We are sleeping under the same godforsaken roof, a thing I'd hoped never to experience again. But he's here, staying on base in his own private quarters until he feels confident enough to leave, which means he'll be fixing our problems by wreaking havoc on Sector 45, which means I will be reduced to becoming his puppet and messenger, because my father never shows his face to anyone except those he's about to kill. He is the supreme commander of the reestablishment and prefers to dictate anonymously. He travels everywhere with the same select group of soldiers, communicates only through his men, and only in extremely rare circumstances does he ever leave the capital. News of his arrival at Sector 45 has probably spread around base by now and has likely terrified my soldiers, because his presence, real or imagined, has only ever signified one thing: torture. It's been so long since I felt like a coward. But this is bliss. this protracted moment, this illusion of strength. Being out of bed and able to bathe, it's a small victory. The medics wrapped my injured arm in some kind of impermeable plastic for the shower, and I'm finally well enough to stand on my own. My nausea has settled, the dizziness is gone. I should finally be able to think clearly, and yet, my choices still seem so muddled. I've forced myself not to think about her, but I'm beginning to realize I'm still not strong enough, not just yet, and especially not while I'm still actively searching for her. It's become a physical impossibility. Today, I need to go back to her room. I need to search her things for any clues that might help me find her. Kent's and Kishimoto's bunks and lockers have already been cleared out. Nothing incriminating was found. But I'd ordered my men to leave her room. Juliet's room, exactly as it was. No one but myself is allowed to re-enter that space, not until I've had the first look. And this, according to my father, is my first task. That'll be all, Delalu. I'll let you know if I require assistance. He's been following me around even more than usual lately. Apparently, he came to check on me when I didn't show for the assembly I'd